Most Americans believe racism is a major problem. But what about Maine? Is racism a serious problem here? We've all heard that Maine is one of the whitest states in the nation. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, 95% of Maine residents identify as Caucasian. Because of that, many people feel like Maine is insulated from the kind of racism and violence making news in other states. But people of color who live in Maine tell a different story. They experience everything from insensitive comments to outright threats. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss racism in Maine and in the nation. How Barack Obama's presidency, the current presidential campaign, new immigrants, and economic anxiety have fueled racism and what can be done. How do you view racism in Maine? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news update. From the MPBN studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Racism is one of the most charged issues of our day. We see it in the Black Lives Matter movement, the polarizing talk in the presidential campaign, conflicts on college campuses over racial insensitivity, and anti-immigrant attitudes across the country. We can only address a segment of this huge topic today as we talk about the nature of racism in our society, how it's changing, and whether it's a problem here in Maine. Joining us from our studio, Reverend Kenneth Lewis, pastor of the Green Memorial AME Zion Church in Portland. Susan Howe, community organizer, social worker, and interfaith chaplain. She also interned with the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Professor Brian Purnell, associate professor of Africana Studies and History at Bowdoin College. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you feel as though racism is a serious problem in our country and in our state? And do you think attitudes are changing? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. But before we turn to today's topic, we want to welcome Lucas St. Clair to the program. As you've probably heard by now, this morning, President Obama declared the Katahdin Woods and Waters a national monument. Yesterday, a foundation created by Roxanne Quimby donated 87,500 acres of land in that region to the U.S. government. Lucas St. Clair is on the line with us. He is the son of Roxanne Quimby, has been a leading proponent for the designation of his family's land to be a national monument. He's also president of Elliottsville Plantation Incorporated, a foundation that manages the land. Lucas, welcome back to Maine Calling.
Thanks so much. Thanks for having me on.
Lucas, when did you know this was going to happen?
Well, we've had signals over the last several days as we cleared many of the hurdles that it takes to donate land to the federal government. But really, we didn't know for sure until about 10:30 this morning when we got news that the president signed the proclamation and created Katahdin Woods and Waters National Monument.
Perhaps this is too early to ask you this, but what's next? What's the timetable?
Well, I mean, so offices opened up in Patton and in Millinocket today. There are Park Service employees, a superintendent that has been hired and is on the ground now. There's brochures made, a website up, there's maps, there's a lot of infrastructure that has been done over the last couple of weeks, including decking bridges and getting roads ready for low-clearance vehicles. And so there's a lot that's done. And, you know, really for us, it's about turning the page on what was once a really charged debate and now is really an opportunity to move forward and kind of turn the page on the debate and begin working with the communities to capitalize on this monument the best that we can.
Well, what about those who are fearful, who think that this is going to threaten forest jobs?
Well, I think, you know, certainly time will tell, but I've received a lot of phone calls from people and texts and emails today that have been opposed to the park for the whole time and now say, okay, well, the battle was lost, but the real work starts now and it's time to dig in and really look for ways to benefit. I think there's been a lot of kind of misleading information about the fact that this would hurt forest jobs, or this would take away from traditional access, or this would prevent people from doing things that they've been doing there all along. And this isn't taking any land out of the timber basket. You know, that the land that is in part of the monument hasn't been harvested for many years. And all the uses that are allowed yesterday are allowed today. So you can hunt and you can fish and you can drive snowmobiles on all the land that was where those activities were allowed. So there's no loss of opportunity because of this proclamation. And really what we have to gain is the fact that this is going to be recognized nationally. This is the President of the United States and his closest advisors recognizing that this part of the North Woods is worthy of being recognized as one of the crown jewels of the American landscape. So, you know, this is an incredibly exciting opportunity, and we really are looking forward to moving on and working with the community to do what's next.
Lucas, I'm sure your head is spinning right now, but I'm wondering if you'd like to share some of the reflections on what this means to you, your mom, others you've worked with.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's been such a huge opportunity. I was joking this morning saying that if Elliottsville Plantation put out a help wanted job posting for this position, I would have never been hired for it. But my mom had a huge amount of confidence and faith in me to give me the opportunity to work on this. And it's been such a wild ride. I've learned so much. I've built incredibly strong friendships with so many people in the Katahdin region. There are people that have been so incredibly supportive of this and have just gone above and beyond to make this a possibility. And so I reflect back on time that, you know, it's like parenting where the minutes go so slowly, but the days go by so fast. And here we are. I can't believe it's just 5 years has whisked by, but it's a very exciting time to think back on. And really it's been about the people that I've had the opportunity to work with and the huge opportunity that my mother gave to me to do this.
Well, Lucas, thanks so much for joining us today on Maine Calling. We'll have much more on this story later on the newscast on Maine Things Considered and other newscasts throughout the day. Lucas Sinclair, president of the Elliottsville Plantation, a foundation that managed the 87,000-plus acres that were designated a national monument by President Obama earlier today. And we're going to turn now to the subject we had planned for the day. And Brian Purnell, I'd like to start with you. We're talking about racism, but I want to start with a definition. Would you define racism as prejudice against someone because of the color of their skin? Or is that kind of a superficial and old-fashioned definition?
It's not superficial. I think, though, that it sounds very vague. What kind of prejudice? There's all sorts of predispositions towards bias and prejudice that people carry with them. And prejudice in and of itself doesn't amount to racism. When we use the term racism, it's probably hearkening back to some of the early or mid-20th century phenomenon in global history that came out of World War II and Nazism and the totalitarianism. And a shorthand definition that I use for racism is when you turn people into things and you then have policies and practices based on that turning of a person or an individual into a thing based on some sort of physical characteristic. That's where the race comes into it. So, you know, skin color or physical appearance or hair texture, or there's a whole host of bugaboos that people have attached to dehumanizing individuals or groups and then acting in specific ways based on that turning of the individual into a thing. That's how I would think about racism.
Reverend Lewis, I think a lot of people in Maine see the news around the rest of the country and think to themselves, I'm so glad I live in Maine where we don't have that kind of racism intention. I want to ask you, what does Maine look like from your perspective?
Well, I think one of the other definitions or key phrases that is associated with racism is power and privilege. In Maine, there exists power and privilege that's based on long history of race. And so this implicit bias, this structural and institutional policy development over years and years of time has created an environment where those persons who are in the majority don't recognize implicit bias. Race is dealt with on an everyday basis for those who lack position, privilege, and power. And so in Maine, in Portland more specifically, where I live, it's seen, it's felt, it's known, it's heard, because persons of privilege and power have the ability to act out those implicit structural or institutional biases without repercussion.
Mm. Susan Howe, you worked with the Maine Wabanaki State Child Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which is dealing with a really dark chapter in Maine history when Native American children were taken from their homes and placed with white families, many of whom abused them. That era is past, but prejudice exists. What do people of Wabanaki descent continue to confront in Maine?
Well, starting with the children, one of the findings of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission is that still in 2015, Native children are removed from their homes and tribes at a 5% greater, 1 in 5 greater percent rate than other children.
So although it's not a policy, individual decisions more often tilt toward removal.
Well, I think it's not the individuals. The social workers on the line are doing the best they can, but again, as Reverend Lewis was saying, it's institutionally written into the codes and laws, and it's deeply in there that Native children are not really seen from way back when, you know, Europeans first arrived on the shores as fully human. They are, you know, lesser in some way, similar to what Brian was saying.
Do you all believe that? I think a lot of people believe that racism is on the rise in this country. Do you think that that's the case, or do you think we're finally unpeeling a layer that we've been hiding for a little while?
I think there's I don't think it's necessarily on the rise. I think it's been uncovered. The opportunity to create discomfort amongst the majority and to address it. I think the movements that have occurred there's an element of strength now to address it and not to just deal with it. These types of actions and actors have existed for a long time. And I think generations have learned to tolerate this malinformation, this maladjusted mindset. But I think addressing these issues openly and honestly and consistently has uncovered kind of this hidden issue where the majority has not had the need to address it.
Mm. I would just say I like the question. And I think it's wrong to think of racism as something that kind of goes and rises and falls. It's not really that useful to say, you know, that there's a moment in history where racism is really bad and then it goes away and comes back. There's a really good historian who wrote in the 1960s. His name is Winthrop Jordan. And in 1966, he had this statement where he said, if you want to understand people's attitudes about race in America, then you have to understand their attitudes about everything else. So it's not something, racism isn't something that's just isolated in a corner and it kind of flares up and diminishes. It's tied into the ways that Americans feel and respond to other anxieties and fears and stresses in their social and political world.
So we see, for example, when there's economic anxiety, that's tied in with this sort of ugly other side of the page.
Yeah, well, there, you know, historically speaking, when, you know, when Americans have experienced tremendous amounts of economic insecurity, joblessness, contractions in the ability of people to get jobs, and that corresponds with increases in immigration, let's say, from Ireland, if we're talking about the 19th century. There's enormous amounts of racism against Irish Catholics because they're Irish Catholics. And there's that dehumanization process that turns these individuals or this religious group or this ethnicity into things. And you can see this in mainstream media, print culture. You can see it in popular culture in vaudeville. You can see it in discriminatory policies against Irish Catholics in cities like Boston, Philadelphia, New York, where they can't work, et cetera. And it's racism and prejudice corresponds to moments of anxiety, fear, competition, and it's kind of a fallback that Americans have for collapsing complexity. So instead of talking about how there's contractions in the job market, let's say, and how there's competition for jobs and employers or corporations or whoever are trying to squeeze as much out of workers as possible, instead of talking about how there's that type of competition in the workplace, people can collapse the complexity and just say, it's the immigrants, they're taking our jobs, right? When in reality, there's a lot more going on that we should talk about as Americans instead of just simplifying it with racism.
Susan, you're a chaplain. Kenneth, you're a pastor. Tell us, what do we do now? Give us the answers.
Well, I agree. I think that we're just, we've put a lot of Band-Aids over many wounds in the past, whether it's with Native people or all people of color, and the way we treat the environment, and that they're all interrelated, and that our knee-jerk response when things get hard is to fight back with fear and to leverage our pain instead of our power. And that turns into oppression or dominance in some way or another. And that for Wabanaki Reach, which is the organization I work for now, we are really trying to focus on what it means to be white in this country and as opposed to a person of color, and what can white people do to become more aware, to begin to take apart the structures that have been so oppressive to all other people for so long. And that place is to begin with our own awareness of our own selves and our own prejudices and the institutions that we are complicit with that continue to give us privilege as white people.
I think it's also important to acknowledge the history of our country institutionally and structurally. If you went back to Bacon's Rebellion, post-Bacon's Rebellion in Virginia, pitted poor whites and indentured servants and slaves against one another to protect power and privilege. And that was prior to the U.S. Constitution being written and ratified. This sentiment of power and privilege pits people against one another, which creates a seedbed whereby we exacerbate differences and not similarities. And so deep within the DNA of this country, in all of its structures, in all of its growing, in all of its building, that mindset prevailed. It prevailed in its laws. It prevailed in its institutions. It prevailed through redlining from a housing perspective. It prevailed through access to capital and banking. It prevailed. And if we don't acknowledge the fact that it is part of the DNA of the country, then I think we have constant challenges as to its authenticity.
Believe it or not, we have to take a break already. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Our email address, talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Patriot Subaru, providing sales, service, and accessories on new and pre-owned all-wheel drive Subarus on Route 1 in Saco.
So on any given day, you are lied to between 10 and 200 times, and that's why you need to become a lie spotter. What do you think about my hair?
Your hair's great. Swear to God, on my mother's grave.
Right,
that's what we would call a religious reference combined with overemphasizing one's truthfulness.
I'm Guy Raz. Why we lie, why we believe them. Next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Coming up tonight at 11 o'clock and a new episode on Saturday afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio. If you're a regular MPBN radio listener, you've heard this following phrase more than once. Support for MPBN is made possible in part by, and then the names of local businesses and organizations. These groups know well the value of MPBN in our community, the benefit of association with our programming, and reaching you, the statewide public radio audience. If you would like to learn more, visit mpbn.net and click on Business Support. There you can find information about the value of sponsorship, answers to frequently asked questions, and contact information. Or you can just give us a call, 800-884-1717. Ask for Susan Tran. Thank you for your support of public broadcasting here in Maine.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the nature of racism in our nation and in our state. With me in our studio, Susan Howe, who's a community organizer who has worked with the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission. She's also a chaplain. Brian Purnell, associate professor of Africana Studies and History at Bowdoin. And Kenneth Lewis, pastor of Portland's Green Memorial AME Zion Church. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mpbn.net, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Also joining us on the line now is Phil Walsh. He is Executive Director of Maine Initiatives. Phil, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Jennifer.
Tell us a little bit more about Maine Initiatives as done on the issue of racism here in Maine.
Sure. So Maine Initiatives is a progressive community-based foundation here in Maine, and our mission is to fund and strengthen organizations whose work is advancing social, economic, and environmental justice in our communities. And that's a really broad mission in certain respects. So over the past year, we had a series of conversations, community-based conversations around the state to identify what the priority justice and equity issues are within our stakeholders and in communities around the state. And in that context, we heard three major issues emerge across the state. There were economic inequality was a major issue, issues related to climate change, and then issues related to racism, racial justice, and racial equity emerged as a really prevalent issue across the state. So in sort of doing an analysis of those issues, we identified there were certain things that were unique about the issues of race and racism that were felt in our community that made it a priority for us to focus our resources and our efforts on. One of those was this idea that there was sort of a market gap, that if people felt like racial justice and racial equity were really high priorities in their life and for their community, they didn't necessarily know what to do about it. If they perceived racism, or if they perceived that there was institutional or systemic racial injustices, there wasn't a place to go. There wasn't an organization that was obviously leading on that issue. And if they wanted to donate, or if they wanted to support leaders, or even if they wanted to volunteer, how do you get engaged on issues of racial justice and racial equity? So,
okay, Phil, I'm going to ask my guests here if they would have an answer for someone who said that in one of your meetings. How would someone become involved in promoting social justice and racial equality in their communities?
Well, certainly Maine Wabanaki Reach offers workshops that people can come to learn about the truth of Wabanaki history and its relationship to Maine history. And those workshops are a day long and they're free. And we have over 400 people in the state who've come to them to learn about the truth about the history, and then the second half of the day is all about what does it mean to be a Maine white person or non-native, and address the issues of looking at our own privilege and how we remain complicit in those institutions.
Okay, I'll put that on our MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page if you'll give me the information after the program,
sure.
Kenneth.
I think well-intentioned persons have to be willing to take a risk. And that means addressing the systemic institutional issues head on all the time, every time, within their families, within their circles of influence, within amongst their friends. You have to take a risk if, in fact, you believe in racial justice, you believe in economic justice. As an individual, you have an opportunity to make a difference because you know people. And a person in the majority can be silent in the midst of others and be complicit. But
Let me ask you this. It takes a risk.
There
have been a couple things out in the news in the last couple of years where something has happened in public and someone has witnessed it. Let's say you're sitting at an outdoor cafe and you witness something that bothers you. Somebody calls somebody a name, a racial epithet, or say something unkind, and you're a stranger. Does one stand up and say something? Say that's not okay? Or is that make it worse and more embarrassing for the person that it's...
I guess the question is, do I stand up? I stand up immediately.
Does any of our listeners stand up?
I don't think so. I think some may. Some may write it off. Some may say they're just ignorant and so you should ignore it. And I don't think ignoring it is the thing to do. Mm-hmm. I'm an advocate of addressing it. I think there's an opportunity for constructive confrontation. And I think the persons who have the greatest opportunity to do that are the folks who don't necessarily look just like me.
Right. And can I jump in on that? Because, first of all, I want to thank Reverend Lewis for his comments. You know, we in the majority white community often call on Reverend Lewis and other leaders in the black community to be interpreters or translators or spokespersons for issues of race and racial justice. And I think what Reverend Lewis is saying, and even though that's not in his job description, he does it, and he does it with such eloquence and grace and forbearance. But I think his point here is so important. We, as people who don't suffer from racial injustice and racial equity, need to make racial justice and racial equity priorities in our own lives and in our own actions, in our own deeds, or it's impossible to achieve. So it does take us standing up, acknowledging it. And Jennifer, I want to thank you for having this conversation, because this is the first step in being able to do that, is having open, frank conversations where we're able to articulate some painful, some challenging, and some potentially disruptive things about us and our own community.
Well, Phil Walsh, thank you so much for joining us today. Phil is the Executive Director of Maine Initiatives, and we will post your report on the MPBN Maine Calling Facebook page. I do want to get to some of the other calls, though. So many people have been waiting for a while now. We're going to start with Sam, who's calling from Bangor. Hi, Sam. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I wanted to say that I moved to Maine from a diverse place, and I was really struck at the lack of racism and racial tension in the area. And then we had two elections, both the Governor LePage election, re-election, and the Ben Chin election down in Lewiston. And it made me really aware of the fact that actually there is a lot of racism in Maine. It's just not something that we ever talk about because we lack that diversity. But when it does come up, it's actually really mind-blowing. I talked to some folks down in Lewiston around the Ben Chin elections, and the number of people who just flat out said, I am not voting for the Chinese guy, the number of people who just very blatantly said we need to protect our kids from black people, it was just really, really terrible and really, really discouraging. And so while, white people in Maine just don't see it very often and don't hear it very often, for people of color in Maine, you know, this is still their daily lives. This is still what they have to go through day after day with this very blatant discrimination.
All right. Well, Sam, thanks for your call. Do any of you have a comment?
I agree.
I agree, too.
Okay. Thank you, Sam, for your call. We're going to move to Mohammed, who's calling from Lewiston. Hi, Mohammed. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. I can say today, in America, racism is getting a lot worse. Since Donald Trump is running for the president, and as we can say, Donald Trump came four times or three times, exactly, I don't know the number, to state of Maine. And the last time he came, you remember what he says, about the Somalian community. So that is the only time, the only thing he want to say that he came to the state of Maine. And our governor, LePage, was right there with him, and he never say anything. He just listened and he didn't say nothing. And the Somalian community, the benefit of the Somalian community in Lewiston, the city of Lewiston was dying for a long time since the Somalian come. Today, the Lewiston is the best, fast-growing city in America. So Donald Trump don't know that. And at the same time, Donald Trump, he don't know the state of Maine and Lewiston is the Somalian living. So our governor is, I can say today, he's a racist too. Thank you.
All right. Professor Purnell, how does the presidential campaign and the election of our governor fit in to what you study, the historical perspective of politics and race in America?
We shouldn't. I think Sam and Muhammad's points are very important. You know, elections are these opportunities where individual candidates have to try to create, you know, coalitions and excitement around themselves as personality figures, as representatives of a party, et cetera. So there's always going to be a history of individuals running for office trying to, you know, pander to a certain population. I'm not going to speak directly about the current campaign. I do want to look back. I was thinking about today's show. I was thinking about the 1988 presidential campaign when George H.W. Bush ran against Michael Dukakis, and the Republicans ran this these ads about Willie Horton. So people who don't remember that can maybe look it up or learn about it. But it was this incredibly powerful way that the Republicans discredited Dukakis because of a prisoner release program that he had in Massachusetts that then wound up releasing a prisoner who assaulted a woman. And Willie Horton is African-American. So there was just this plastering of Willie Horton's face all around the country during that campaign. And one of the strategists during that campaign for Bush said that by the time we're done with this ad campaign, people will think that Willie Horton is Dukakis' running mate. So there's a way that politics and trying to energize individuals to act on behalf of a candidate can play to some of the worst practices in American culture and in American life. And that's just needling people's fears and people's anxieties and taking something like racial prejudice, prejudice against black people, prejudice against black male prisoners, and using that as a way to say, vote for this guy. He's going to protect you from this boogeyman that we're creating. And it's I'm not surprised that the callers would point to elections and would point to these political moments as times when racism kind of gets ratcheted up in public discourse.
We have an email from Matt in Kittery. He writes, racism is in the current news because of our smartphones and social media. It's good to have this issue discussed so we can move forward. But it's also important to know that race relations in the USA have never been better. And he has never in italics. And I think there are those who agree with Matt who say the majority of Americans voted for an African-American man for president, not once, but twice. Things are improving.
I thank Matt for his comments. Never been better. I don't know about all that. I think that there's some significant economic, educational inequities that exist. And quite honestly, because the populace decided that Barack Obama was the best candidate twice, doesn't necessarily mean that they vote for him just because he was a black man. I don't think so. I think the willingness to vote for the better candidate makes some sense, but that he's not the poster child for African-Americanism. Ask the person who is trying to get a loan at the bank. Ask the person who gets looked at strangely at a coffee shop. Ask the person who goes to a restaurant, who works at a restaurant and a person comes in and says, I don't want you to make my sandwich. So every day, those exist here in Maine.
We have to take another break. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. This is Maine Calling.
You make Maine Calling possible, as does Casella, committed to safe, efficient disposal of non-recyclable waste for all 16 Maine counties. Casella, giving resources new life. And St. Joseph's College Online MBA, emphasizing critical thinking, social responsibility, and leadership. More at sjcmba.com.
So how you doing?
I feel great.
You know, I've been Googling brain tumors. A lot more common than you think.
John Krasinski, who co-starred in The Office, directed and stars in the new film The Hollers, about a family dealing with the illness of its matriarch, played by Margot Martindale. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Krasinski about the film and his 9 seasons on The Office. Join us.
That's ahead tonight at 7 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio. And looking ahead to our 2 o'clock Public Affairs Hour today, World Affairs brings us Michelle Nunn, President and CEO of CARE USA. She'll be discussing how organizations can provide Syrian refugees the resources to build a brighter future. That's at World Affairs, coming up at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the programming, on the program, Racism in Maine and the U.S., joining me today, Brian Purnell with Bowdoin College. He's an associate professor of Africana Studies and History. Kenneth Lewis is the pastor of Green Memorial AME Zion Church. And Susan Howe, community organizer and social worker who has worked with the Wabanaki community and still does, join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. I'm going to go to Portland and Arthur. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead.
Hi there. So I want to speak to the denial that goes on. All of my friends and colleagues who say, I'm not racist, I'm not part of the problem. And I wish that I could say that, but I'm afraid it's not true. I'm polite, and I certainly wouldn't think of uttering a racial slur, but much too often I will see somebody of color in a place that's mostly white, and a voice in me says, what's he or she doing here? And instantly another voice answers, says, Arthur, you silly guy, he or she belongs here. Well, the first is the voice of the racism I grew up with, and the second is are the core values that I've adopted. I could wish that that's just my own private journey, but I would be astounded if Reverend Lewis and other people of color don't see that very, very often. So when we all say, I'm not racist, I'm not part of the problem, I think without beating our chest and a feeling of huge guilt, we can say, of course I'm part of the problem. How can I be part of the solution? How can I acknowledge that this was taught to me in words and by example? I grew up in New York City in an upper middle class housing project that was designed to be all white. It's in the contractual agreements that created it. And so, of course, I grew up to believe that the world that I'm in ought to be white. I don't believe that anymore, but I'm stuck with the remnants of that, and they show. And I need to be part of a dialogue that helps us get past that.
Well, you're part of a dialogue right here and now. Go ahead, Susan.
I really appreciate your comment about being aware of your thoughts, because I think that's a huge place to start, that many of us, and I'm a white woman, have, don't think of ourselves as racist in terms of our behavior, our words. But boy, you watch those little subtle messages come in through your brain when you see a situation and you know it's part of your training as part of this huge white culture. And that until we notice that, we can't do anything about it. I think a huge piece of moving forward is that white people swim in white water. We don't see how we are racist. And in that way, we do need the voices of people of color to show us where we are bumping into things that we aren't aware of, because we can't. It's like fish can't see the water that they swim in. And I know for me, when I have an opportunity to speak really openly and honestly, and I'm courageous enough, as Reverend Lewis was saying, to listen and really listen, I learn a lot about my own biases, and I have to be ready to not get defensive and to be honest and humble and learn, because I'm going to be a student of this for my whole life as a white person.
I think one of the things that I would add is that just like Arthur, I recognize when I'm the only person in the room. So while he's looking in my direction, I've already looked all around me, and I know that I'm the only person of color in a setting. But I'm confident enough and mature enough to still carry that. My presence at times can create the dissonance, the confrontation, to put people on blast, as the young people would say, to address issues head on, because there's not a shy bone in my body. I don't have a problem addressing something immediately. I have the privilege of pastoring a historic African-American church that is probably the most diverse place on a Sunday morning that you could ever be in the city of Portland. I've had to learn. I grew up in Boston, segregated Boston, went to segregated schools in the city of Boston. I've had to mature in my outlook towards people who are not like me. And so as a person who has long lineage as a Native American as well, you don't see that when you look at me, maybe, but I can get offended on many different fronts, and I don't mind addressing the issue. I don't mind taking the risk, because I don't see it as a risk. I see it as an absolute reward every single time, that if I have the opportunity to impact anyone in a particular room on this issue or any other issue of significance, I feel it is my calling and my responsibility to do that. Like me, don't like me, what have you. I go home, my wife and my kids will always love me.
Brian, I want to ask you about the students at Bowdoin. You can tell me if I'm wrong here, but I'm assuming that most of them are really nice kids, well-intentioned, smart, hardworking, and are maybe uncomfortable talking about issues of race and confronting their own feelings that they're not proud of, or talking to others who are different than they are. I had a discussion with a young college student recently who said, it's so hard to have an authentic conversation because everyone's trying to be so polite. Do you find that?
Not in my classes.
Okay.
I mean, but I don't, it's tough to characterize it with a broad brushstroke. I think, you know, first of all, let me just, you know, Bowdoin is a wonderful place to work. It's small though, right? I mean, it's a small place. There's only about less than 2,000 students there. I wouldn't want to use that small population as a barometer for anything but that small population. Having said that, they have conversations all the time. People are trying to work through these issues in public, in their dorms, on their teams. And sometimes they make mistakes, and sometimes they get it right. And there's administrators, there's professors, there's concerned students who are working on it all the time. I think that's the best thing that I see where I work when it comes to thinking about and dealing with racism, which is a part of our history and a part of our contemporary nation and culture. It's just people are trying to work on it. They're not always going to get it right, and they just keep working on it. And that's more important than getting it right or offending somebody or being perfect. It's the willingness to work on it as a community.
All right. We're going to go to Bridgeton and Victoria. Hi, Victoria. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you? It's a great conversation. I would just start by saying the professor from Bowdoin might also tell the public that the Africana collection that he works at Bowdoin holds the history also of African people of African descent in Maine since the colonial period. And I think that's what this kind of conversation misses. Just to say that Maine is a very white state makes the people of color here invisible to the listener. We have a history that is long and deep from the War for Independence, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, businesses, farms, every possible thing you can imagine, that we have been here. We are here. Families whose families have been here for generations deep. And I think it might help the readers to know that there was a book some years ago written by our first African-American legislator in Maine, Gerald Talbot, and Harriet Price, a writer. It's called Maine's Visible Black History. The book is very thick, and it's full of photographs of old families, et cetera. The Sampson Center for the Sampson Center in the University of Southern Maine in Portland has the Sampson Center a collection, and it also contains a collection of African American history, people, pictures, documents from Africans, people of African descent who have been all over Maine for its beginnings. And we have had so many young people who are no longer young people who have graduated from high school, graduated from colleges, done well in school. Sometimes they move away. Oftentimes the last generation, they bring families back to go camping. So just to eliminate us from the conversation of being in Maine, we do everything. We ski, we hunt, we fish, we boat, we send our kids to school. We have racial incidents in the street and at our workplaces. But, you know, this is Maine, this is America, and we're here. So
and sure, Victoria,
better,
and to your point, one goes to the Maine State Museum in Augusta, and the Talbot, a room from the Talbot House is on display with a group of other rooms from very typical Maine households through the last century and a half. Do any of you have thoughts about Victoria's comment?
Well, I appreciate it, and I think she's right. That's always a very important part of African-American history. Like, one part of African-American history as a discipline, as a research area, is to say black people, people of African descent have been here, have been contributing, have been parts of American society in all sorts of dynamic ways. This is not to refute that historical reality. Let's think about Maine for, you know, a second, and in terms of its history as a state. Maine exists because of debates, fierce, contentious, divisive debates over slavery. That's why Maine became a state in 1820. We're coming up on the bicentennial in a couple of years. Missouri is going to enter into the Union as a slave state in 1819. Congress compromises and brings in a portion of northern Massachusetts as a free state, right, in 1820. So Maine becomes a free state in 1820. Why would there be so few black people in Maine from the 19th century up through the end of the Civil War, at least, if we can talk in that historical context? Because Maine is still the United States. Up to 1865, there's still slavery in the United States. There's a fugitive slave law. And Maine's real close to Canada. So if I was black and I was in Maine in the 19th century, even though Maine is a free state, I would keep going. Because Canada is freedom. And Maine, at least up until 1865, is still in a country that has slavery. All right, so, you know, without question, people of African descent, Native Americans, Francophone Catholics, there are all sorts of ways that Maine is an incredibly diverse, pluralistic place, and that should be a part of the state's history. Maine is also a part of the United States, and that's kind of what we're talking about right now with this conversation. How does a history of racism and how do contemporary manifestations of prejudice and bigotry, how does that affect who we are as people in this country?
I also think it's important to recognize that whiteness transcends ethnicity and country of origin. It's easier to assimilate to the majority when you look like them. Mm-hmm. And so I agree with everything with what the professor said. But it's important to recognize that if I choose to be here, I want to be respected. I want the same access. I want the same rights and privileges that any other citizen might have. I really get charged and challenged with the debate and conversation around immigrants when we're a country that has its greatest growth and development based on immigration. We can contest immigration when there's more melanin content in someone's skin pigmentation. It's okay that people come in from Ellis Island, from Europe, but it's not necessarily okay that people come from the west coast of Africa. So if you take those persons who are African Americans, their lineage and their heritage, a lot of folks didn't choose to come this way. We had a middle passage that existed. Young people were taught how to handle and deal with inherent racist society. There was economic issues, lack of job access, and so forth. And so there's an element of trust that needs to be established if, in fact, allies and those who are most affected by racist regimes, if you will, are going to move forward. And so how do you build up that trust? I think you do it one person at a time. I think you do it one policy at a time. You do it one ordinance at a time. But it's something that has to be worked at 24/7. It has to continue to be worked at. And if not, you're going to continue to have individuals who feel as if they're not treated fairly, and they're not treated fairly based solely on the color of their skin.
Susan, you're nodding.
I'm just thinking that I think the question that we all have to come down to in ourselves is, you know, who do we want to be as a human race, as a human species, and how do we want to treat each other, and how do we want to treat the world? And that when we get down to that and our true values, I think that most of us want to know the truth, and we want to heal the wounds that are there, and we want to move forward. And that means moving away from the fear and moving to a place of really trusting and loving the life that exists.
Well, there are so many calls we're not going to get to and emails, but you all have been a really wonderful conversation, and I thank you all for being here. Reverend Kenneth Lewis, pastor of Green Memorial, AME Zion Church in Portland. Susan Howe, a community organizer, social worker, and interfaith chaplain who has worked with the Maine Wabanaki State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And Professor Brian Purnell, associate professor of Africana Studies and History at Bowdoin College. Jonathan Woodward ran the board today. Cindy Hahn answered your calls. You can find past editions of Maine Calling, as well as a link to our audio archives at mainecalling.net. Today's program will be rebroadcast this evening at 8. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. Thursday on the program, raising backyard chickens. What are the pros and cons of being a chicken keeper? Maybe a lighter topic than today's, but still a very hot topic here in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.